So I'm going to invite Dave to come and join me up on the stage, and we'd like to give him a really big warm welcome this evening. Dave, come and join me up here. Can we just do a quick sound check? Do you want to say hi and see if we're all...
Hello, have I passed the first hurdle of this evening?
Can you hear Dave?
Good, that's a bonus, that's good.
Dave, really warm welcome to Chapel Town. It's a delight to have you here this evening. Just tell us where you've come from this evening, a little bit about your family, that sort of thing. Just be helpful to know a bit.
So myself and Louise and our son Joe live over in Crooks. Mm-hmm. Had the blessing of being in High Green this evening, though, because my friend and colleague Bex has, well, she hasn't cooked us tea, let's be honest, her husband's cooked us tea. But ordinarily, we're over in Crooks.
Great. And what's the day job for you, Dave? What have you been doing kind of during this week? What's your normal pattern of life?
So I've got two community teams. So I've got a team that works with the councillors. So I have an officer who covers the Northern Council wards. And then another team, which my colleague Bex works for, which is guys who work out GP surgeries and do early intervention stuff. So two teams that cover the city for the council that I manage.
Lovely. So for Sheffield City Council?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
great, okay. Of course, you're not from around here.
No.
We can tell a little bit, but people might be trying to guess the accent. You're from Bristol.
I am from Bristol, yes.
Tell us a bit about growing up in Bristol and what that was like.
So Bristol's lovely. I had to leave Bristol to realise it was lovely. I think it took me about 5 years.
yes.
So I grew up there and then I came here to be a student. Not a geography student, because I actually came to Sheffield because it was a long way from Bristol. And if I'd been a geography student, clearly I could have gone to Aberdeen or somewhere. But yeah. I kind of needed a fresh start and I've loved coming up to Sheffield and it's become a home for me.
I've got to ask, what happened to your accent?
Yeah, the accent was never really there. And Louise says if the accent had been there, she'd be married to someone else now.
Do we take it Louise is from around here then? She's a Yorkshire.
Louise is from St. Helens.
Keep quiet about that, but that's fine. Yeah, great. So you came to Sheffield as a student.
That's right.
But grew up in Bristol. Just tell us about your family in Bristol. What was that like as a kid growing up? How was that for you?
So family was messy, and I kind of grew up figuring that out because my parents had split up before I was born. So I grew up into that situation. My mum then remarried. She married a guy whose wife had died, leaving him with two children. So you basically got two very broken people who came together and got married. Yeah. And that meant that there was an awful lot of hurt. Not necessarily, it wasn't a kind of tempestuous sort of, it was far more sort of suppressed and subdued. And so there was a lot of stuff under the surface growing up. And, you know, it was difficult, really. It was not a sort of warm family to grow up in.
Yeah. So you move up to Sheffield, you're studying. What was it like coming to Sheffield? How did you find that?
Great. Sheffield became a home. I think I kind of had been here a couple of years, didn't have a pull to go back and had been involved in the church here and really, you know, Sheffield began to feel like home.
Yeah. What made you stay? What were the kind of key things about being here?
I think part of the thing, I was involved in St. Thomas's Church. I did my degree, which was in sociology, which is a little bit of a kind of subject of mirth again in my family, not quite being a proper degree. But you don't do a sociology degree and then have a really clear life plan. It's not that sort of degree.
Okay.
So I was involved in a great church and they did a training year and that led me to go and join another church that I'd been placed with. So it kind of followed on, I guess, one thing after another, but things sort of unfolded in a good way where there were positive things for me to be doing up here.
Obviously, you came to Sheffield. I presume you managed to form allegiance with at least one of the great football teams in the city?
I have a really diplomatic answer for this, which is that...
Do we want the diplomatic or the honest? No, give us the diplomatic first.
Genuinely, the diplomatic answer is that my Sheffield football team is Hallam. So I've started going to watch Hallam, and I really enjoy going to watch Hallam.
Okay,
that's the diplomatic answer. The less diplomatic answer is, are there any blades in the room? Okay.
There's one or two hands up. Yeah, go on.
I support the London team that are very unpopular with Sheffield United. So that's the less diplomatic answer. Sorry.
They'll sort you out later.
Yeah, they will.
That's great. So you came to Sheffield University. What was next for you, Dave? What was the kind of next step after you?
Yeah, so I did university. I did this training year because it was there to do, and I didn't have a particularly clear plan. Training year at my church up in Crooks. And they placed me with this church in Darnall, which was a great little, very kind of rough and ready church, people that wanted to get stuck into the community. Yeah. And that was what my heart was for. Yeah. So I felt drawn to go and join that church. So I went and joined that church, and I kind of worked for that church for a number of years in a kind of ad hoc way, got stuck in there.
Now, I need to ask a little bit about romance, if that's okay. Is that all right? Louise, you mentioned from St. Helens.
Yep.
So where did your two paths cross, and how did you first meet and all that stuff?
Well, this is quite a nice story, actually. So me and Louise had met a couple of times and made absolutely no impression on each other.
Right.
And then we're getting towards, it's 1999, you're sort of getting towards the end of the year, and we were in a pub in Crooks. And Louise, basically, there was a guy that Louise felt very uncomfortable with, so she dispatched our mutual friend to talk to this other guy. And she said to me, "Talk to me!" And I was kind of, started talking to Louise.
Yeah.
And then got a bit interested. So then church had, for Millennium Night, I don't know if you can remember what you did on Millennium Night, St. Tom's, they had an all-night event. And so I'd gone up to this with our mutual friend Giles, with a bit of an eye on, it'd be really good to talk to Louise.
Yes.
And we spent most of the night talking, so began to get a bit excited. I thought, this seems good. Yeah. And we got married in the July.
Oh, my word. So that's fairly determined, fairly quick.
Yeah, kind of. We're not very patient people.
I wondered, you know, you talked a little bit about growing up and how family life had been for you. Did that give you at all any hesitation about, because obviously you quite quickly got married. Had you had any reservations about that, or what was that like for you, Dave?
I think actually, partly, faith was a way to sort of, for both of us to deal with our emotional baggage. We both came from divorced families, and that's difficult. So partly there was a way to start to process some of that.
Yeah.
But I think also for both of us actually was thinking, I think this can work better than that. So rather than sort of being shy of relationships and the idea of marriage, thinking, you know, let's find a way to do this well. Yeah. And within our faith, that was the thing to think, you know, we still believe in this as an idea, and this is a way to work out how you can have a good marriage, actually.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned your faith several times there. I just want to pick up on that if I can, Dave. Had you come from a home where church and talk of God was a kind of everyday thing? Was that part of your life as you grew up?
It wasn't to begin with. So what happened was my stepfather used to give music lessons. He started giving this lass a music lesson, and she needed a lift over every week to the lesson. Mm. And the guy that gave her the lift was a vicar. So this vicar starts turning up at our house every week. And to begin with, my mum would hide upstairs. And then after a while, she kind of started to actually come downstairs. And long story short, she, through him, came to faith. So at the age of about 9, we got told one Sunday, we're going to church.
Wow.
Which was a bit weird. Yeah. Got no idea what that meant, really, and what that was going to be like. But it was a church, particularly with a great sort of children's groups.
Yeah.
So, you know, so there was this fairly mad bloke called Roger, and there was a hall, probably about the size of this, and he used to go around with a big bell and ring the bell, and he had a big booming voice, and so we just kind of got stuck in. So from the age of 9, then we were in church, and I was, I guess, beginning to think about faith for myself.
Okay. It obviously, a point where it did become quite real for you personally. Do you want to tell us a bit about how that happened? What was it that drew you that way?
Sure. So my church had a weekend away, and they went away with another youth group. So when I was about 13, and they got a guy in to be a speaker for the weekend. It's the only time that ever happened, because normally our church would just go and the youth leaders would do talks and stuff. So they got this guy in, and he was an evangelist. He just gave the gospel, gave the message. He said, do you want to follow this? And I was just drawn to follow. And I remember very much sensing the presence of God and thinking, yep. So that was good. The church itself was a fairly sort of, I guess I would say, quite traditional church.
Yeah.
So then in terms of faith feeling very real, there was back in Bristol, there was an organization which went into schools, and it ran events, and it started running camps And that was a thing that I got involved in, a bigger thing, and that's where faith probably really started to come alive a bit more.
So this kind of going through your teens, basically, yeah. That kind of, yeah. Were there any other kind of times, either during your teens or later, where you had a kind of what you call a particular experience of God that had particularly been significant for you, Dave?
I think coming here, coming to Sheffield, yes. And coming to St. Tom's was very significant because it's a church that is really open to, I guess, God moving in the here and now and an expectation, yes. That's going to happen. Yes. And God's going to be active in your life and God's going to speak into your life. Yes. So that started to help my faith grow and I guess feel kind of more real and more relevant, really.
Yes.
I do remember one encounter. There's a balcony up in St. Tom's and I remember going one evening to the service and not feeling great, feeling a bit sorry for myself. And there was a guy who'd come to church. He didn't live in Sheffield, he lived in North Wales, but he knew a guy in Sheffield and he'd been sharing his faith. And this guy was interested in coming to church. So we came across from North Wales to bring this guy to church. So he's come to this church for the first time ever. And halfway through the service, he sat behind me, taps me on the shoulder. And he gives me a bit of paper with a Bible verse on. And so I kind of, you've got your Bibles in front of you. Got the Bible out, looked up the Bible verse, and it was one of those Bible verses, if anyone's experienced this, where it feels like it's just been written.
Yeah.
It directly speaks to where you are. Yeah. And it was in that sort of church where there was that expectation that God would speak, and so he could start to deal with things like the baggage I talked about before to start, yeah. To help you process, yeah. The sort of difficult things.
And you felt that was really happening for you. That was, yeah, that's brilliant. Let's come back to family life,
yep.
Or you're married to Louise,
yep.
you're together, and you start a family.
Yep.
Brief a young lad called Joe,
yep.
Who is now, just remind me.
Who's now 17. Unsurprisingly, wow. Joe is taller than me. I think he was about 12, it was never a surprise, but yeah, so he's a strapping 17-year-old, just started his A-levels.
Yeah. How was it first time being parents? How was it for you?
Well, it's a bit easier if you're a bloke, isn't it?
yes.
Because we wanted kids and it was great and you know, yes. I think Louise would look back and go, you know, she loves Joe dearly and we absolutely threw ourselves into him but probably thinks there was postnatal depression there, other stuff and it's really hard work. But yeah. At the same time, a complete joy because we, you know, with our experience of difficult families, we just wanted to pour ourselves into our family and yes. So we did with Joe.
And clearly he didn't put you off, because then
nope.
Came young Ben. And
that's
the
right.
What was the gap between Joe and Ben?
So Ben's just 2 years younger.
Yeah, lovely. And what was Ben like as a little baby and as a little lad? How did you...
So Ben was very determined. So one of the things about Joe was, I think the phrase is polyglot, is that right? I'm looking at my wife because she's a linguist. So Joe was one of these kids who could say anything. So Joe was a kid who would get a pack of Top Trumps at 18 months old and say Lamborghini Murcielago.
Wow.
It was just ridiculously articulate. Ben, at 18 months old, was basically grunting at you and kind of telling you what he wanted you to do.
Yes.
And we kind of figured out, probably at the point where we thought, does he need speech therapy? And then he started talking, that he couldn't be bothered. So he was very strong-willed. He was also very bright, but it was took a little longer for that to emerge.
So it just that experience a lot of parents have, I guess. The first child can be so different.
Yep.
The second, yeah. And so Ben was clearly very unique.
Yep.
It became clear, though, I guess he got to about his fifth year, that things were not things were not well for Ben. What was the kind of first indication of that for you, Dave?
I think it's hard when you look back and you realise there were signs that you didn't spot. But the obvious thing, so we're in about 2010.
Yeah.
And Ben is 5, and he's all of a sudden he's just exhausted, and you think he's got a bug, and you think, well, it's a bug, it'll clear up, and it doesn't clear up, and then has he got another bug, and yeah. You start taking him to the doctors, and the doctor says, no, he's fine, yeah. And yeah. we had, I guess, about a month where Louise starts going back and forth and back and forth,
yeah.
And the symptoms appear quite innocuous, because
yeah.
Actually the symptoms largely, in most children, would be quite innocuous. But it just wasn't clearing up, so there was yeah. Something going on there that just wouldn't yeah. Sort itself out.
Yeah. And so, how did you find out what was causing all this, and what was the reason behind it all?
So eventually, Louise finds herself in the children's hospital, pretty much ready to be told he's fine. And then one of the doctors, I think, spots that he'd fallen asleep, which he kept doing, and went, I think we need to do a scan. Yeah. And I wasn't there, Louise was there, and as she tells the story, the scanning room filled up with doctors.
Right.
So when they did the scan, they found that he'd got a lump in his head, and it was like, right, goodness, we've really got something serious to do with here.
Yeah. And so what did they tell you they were going to do, and what was the kind of, what did they recommend? What was the...
So they were able to explain, they said he's falling asleep because this 5 centimetre growth is pressing on his pituitary, which means he's got no energy because it's stopping that being produced. And they said, we're gonna deal with the swelling and then we're going to operate. And so on the Friday they told us that, and on the Monday they did a day's brain surgery.
Goodness.
to remove pretty much all of this growth.
At this stage, did they know what the growth was? Were there any?
No, at that point I don't think they did, because they hadn't sort of done the biopsy.
Yeah, okay. So you had the surgery on the Monday, and what was the news when they...
So eventually the news came back that this was cancerous, and so the surgery, I mean, we are blessed with an incredible children's hospital. They did an extraordinary job. They got this out, but because of where it was, and you can imagine the sort of veins and nerves, they couldn't completely remove it. And so the next stage is, okay, so you've now got a child with cancer and you're going to be dealing with chemotherapy and radiotherapy.
And that was what they then began.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing for a little lad of that age.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not unique to Ben that kids kind of get on with it.
Yes.
Because you have to, and everybody just sort of, you have your moments, you're incredibly distressed, you're very shocked, but you have to get on with it. And kids get on with it. And I think partly that's how children are, partly it was Ben's personality that he got on with it and he cracked on, really, with, you know, dealt with whatever was thrown his way.
Did it affect his mood or his character, or how did he seem to respond?
Well, part of what was going on with this was it affecting his sight. And so there was a point where it affected his sight, and he pretty much lost his sight, and he became very subdued. And then, essentially, what he worked out, I think, was that he was going to replace his eyes with his mouth, because he was chatty anyway.
Right.
And so he just became even more chatty. And so, That was kind of how he dealt with it. They had a classroom in the hospital.
Yeah.
If he could go to the classroom, he would. If they couldn't, they'd bring it to him.
Yeah.
He had a great rapport with particularly one of the teachers in there.
Yes.
And, you know, he left a mark. So, you know.
Wonderful.
He's you know, been told tonight he's remembered in the hospice.
Right.
8 years on.
Wow. Which is quite something, isn't it? Yeah.
So... Yeah, it was a big personality.
You mentioned he got very chatty. It must have been quite a big thing for you watching as he was losing his sight. I mean, how was that for you and Louise? How did you...
I mean, it's on one level, it's absolutely devastating. And I remember one of these days where, because of the chemotherapy, he ended up having a fit. And then he because of the drugs they gave him to deal with that, he was asleep most of the day. But I remember him coming around... and looking completely disorientated, but being asleep most of the day, and realised that that was him opening his eyes and not being able to see anything. And I remember just being in complete shock about that the day after.
Yes.
But then within a few days of that, it became apparent that he could see some things. And we'd got people praying into all of this, and we'd been told, essentially, he's lost his sight. And then it became pretty clear that he hadn't completely lost his sight, because we could see things he was doing. So it's very distressing. It's sort of back and forth, and all of the time we are getting people to pray, and we're sort of turning this into prayer.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about getting people to pray. Obviously, you've got family, friends, church, and others around you. How did they all, what were their responses? Perhaps start with your family and friends. How did they?
I think people just pitch in. And, you know, our church was amazing and would bring us a cooked meal every night in terms of prayer.
Yeah.
We would get all these different stories of the way that people were praying.
Yeah.
And people just supported us in any way that we could. I mean, I think the point where we left hospital the first time after the surgery, before the chemotherapy had started, we needed a very burly male nurse and about 3 trips to the car, because the amount of stuff that people had brought in.
Wow.
Because people just want to help. And, you know, the school he was at, St. Joseph's in Handsworth, is a sort of one class per year school.
Yes.
So you kind of know everybody, and, you know, they gave us so much support and so wanted to give us some support, so people would come in and give us things and pray, and we'd just be doing whatever they possibly could do, really.
Brilliant. Wonderful. It's wonderful. You talked about praying. I have to ask, Dave, before Ben had been ill, what was your kind of view of sickness, and what do you do when somebody's sick? Do you pray, and what should you pray for? How did you view all of that? What was your understanding in those days?
So I got a really straightforward view at that point in time, which was if somebody gets sick, you pray for them to be healed, and God wants to heal them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really straightforward and quite tidy, but kind of ignores quite a lot of stuff, frankly. But that was the place where I started from.
Yeah.
And partly because that was my faith, and partly because that's what you're desperately seeking for. You're just getting people to pray for him to be healed.
Yeah, yeah. It may sound a silly question, but where this idea that if we pray to God and we're sick, he will heal, where would you say that came from?
Well, I guess there's a few things. So we had experienced God's goodness, and we'd known that God had changed our lives, and we knew that God had changed the lives of people around us, and still absolutely believe that. So we're dealing from a place of faith and a belief in a God who is active and intervenes.
And you'd had answers to prayer, as you would see it.
Yeah. And lots of things, but at the same time, you know, your theology, your way of understanding God, the theology which I guess I'd begun to follow, was this idea essentially that once Jesus has dealt with my sin, as I believe he has, then anything else that's going on, almost as a symptom of that sin, is something that he can deal with as well. And so all that stuff will get sorted out. And so that was my, you know, almost slightly pig-headed approach, is we're going to pray and he's going to get healed.
Yeah. And were others joining in with that? Was there a sense of quite a wave of prayer of people?
Yeah, I mean, people were, and as I'm sure they would be in any comparative situation, incredibly supportive, and that was their desire, and that's what they wanted to see. One of the things that I remember is a couple of months after we'd been in the ward, another Christian family came onto the ward with a boy not at all dissimilar to ours, even with ginger hair like Ben, who got a brain tumour. And they said, we're going to pray and we're going to see, basically, if God says he wants to heal our son. And I remember, and I didn't say it, but I remember thinking, you're idiots. Of course God wants to heal your son.
Right.
Because I'd got a very straightforward way of looking at this. You know, so I think people were pulling for us as they were pulling for Dan, and desperately praying that good would come out of it.
Yes, okay. I'd like to come back to that, because I know you want to say a bit more about that. But just, so we're getting down to late 2010, sort of November time. Ben's had some chemo and then some radiotherapy, is that right? Was that beginning to do any good? What was the? Did you feel encouraged in your praying?
Yeah, massively.
The way things were going?
We had loads of things that were encouragements within the process. Things where we were basically saying to the doctors, "Tell us what to get people to pray for," and people were praying, and really good things were happening.
Yeah.
So the chemotherapy went really well, but they said he's going to need radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And then they said because it hasn't completely gone, he's going to need some more chemotherapy, which is really horrible stuff.
Yeah.
And this is what's called high-dose chemotherapy, and it means that you've got no immunity.
Yeah.
And it meant that if he picked up a bug, as he did, that was really dangerous.
Yes.
And to be honest, I don't think I'd twig to that, because I didn't want to go there. So we ended up with Ben getting a bug. You know, I've just got over a bug. It's a bug. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, sneezed for a few days and felt sorry for myself. Yeah, and got over it. For Ben, it was very dangerous, and what that meant was that he got pneumonia, and he was in intensive care.
Yeah.
And to the point where again, I'm still thinking, well, a few days, you know, he'll be okay, bit of intensive care, you know, on a ventilator. And they basically said, you need to know he's probably not going to make it through this.
Goodness.
Because the amount of oxygen he needed to be able to get into his bloodstream, it wasn't happening.
No.
It wasn't going on. And so we'd got people praying, and the hospital allowed us to pray in the ward, incredibly supportive. And we got to a point one night where we're looking at a monitor. You know, we've all watched Casualty, haven't we? You've got TV monitors, And they're basically saying, look, if this goes down to this rate, you're done for. Mm. And it did. And I'd got two guys in there praying with me, and I just stopped, didn't know what to do. And they went up again. Right. We didn't get an explanation. There were actually Christian doctors who could have tapped me on the shoulder and said, I know it's great and we're all praying, but let me just explain what went on there. Because I'm not that scientific, but I can kind of understand if you've got a lung, it can deflate quite quickly.
Yes.
Don't really understand how one can inflate quite quickly. And these figures just shot up. And from that point onwards, his lungs started to get stronger. Yeah. And he got off the ventilator and he got out of intensive care. And so, with this mindset of we're going to pray and he's going to get healed, I'm thinking, we're over the brow of the hill here. This is we've been up against it and we've come through.
I'd like to ask about other folks who pitched in and supported in various ways. I think while Ben was in hospital, he had one or two quite famous visitors.
Yeah.
Is that right? Tell us a bit about that.
Particularly for the United fans at the back.
Yeah.
Sheffield United came round the hospital and Ben had got a Sheffield United shirt and it said Ben 5 on the back.
Wow.
And he said, the problem is I'm not 5 anymore. And so these two Sheffield United players, it was Chris Morgan, who was the captain at the time, turned up a few weeks later with another shirt with Ben 6 on the back.
Oh, fabulous.
He made a big impression on them.
Yeah. And he had a particular musical band that he enjoyed.
Yeah, he
Go
liked
on.
Madness. He was a big Madness fan.
Oh, right.
So when Madness came to Sheffield and you got these sort of Make-A-Wish Foundation things, so we got to go and see Madness.
Oh, wonderful.
So he's given the drummer of Madness a hug. Oh. It's one of his brushes with fame.
Yeah, lovely. And as you approach folks, were they very open to help with that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think people get it and people just want to help.
Yeah.
He was a mascot down at United as well. They just wanted to help.
Oh, he went down to the match as mascot?
Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, how was that for him? It must have been...
You kind of wonder how much he could take it in some ways.
Yes, because it's such a...
But, people want to help and they just did everything they could. And it was a great day.
So you got through Christmas and New Year. We're into 2011.
Yeah.
And then he had a scan in February.
We had this scan and you would get scans every so often. Mm. And the thing was, when he came out of intensive care, he was so weak that actually he wasn't well enough to have a scan. And he ended up in hospital, not because he was receiving cancer treatment, because he was so weak, because he couldn't digest food properly. So he's getting fed through a tube. And it was February before he could have a scan.
And what did the scan show? Had there been any improvement, or how was he doing?
Well, this was the sort of, frankly, this was us. This was the moment, really. And with everything that had gone on, we're thinking this scan's got to be clear.
Yeah.
And the consultant looked at us. She's a lovely woman and a great doctor, and she said there's something on the scan. Oh. And at that point, that's all you need to hear.
Yeah.
Because we know the medical profession has done a brilliant job and has thrown everything it can at this, and it hasn't worked.
No. And it was clear from there that they could see no way.
No, they everything's been done.
Yeah.
That's the problem at that point. They've done everything they can do.
Can we come back to how you're doing with all this between you and your faith and the church and all that? You'd obviously been praying, you'd seen some encouragements.
Yep.
Some quite remarkable, as you described Ben's lungs and that improvement there. And then this news.
Yeah.
Where did that leave you with God and prayer and all that? Where?
Well, I remember there's a park across the road from Children's Hospital, and I had went over there and I had quite a stiff conversation with God.
Okay.
Which I wouldn't repeat.
Yeah.
And sort of dumbfounded spiritually, and then just thought, well, we carry on praying, because frankly, we've got nothing else now.
Yes. And I'm thinking, not long after that, Ben moved to Bluebell Wood, is that right?
Yeah, so we wanted him home, where essentially that he wasn't being treated anymore.
No.
And so we were able to get him home, which was great. And then we knew about Bluebell, and so basically we were able to go over and check it out. And it's just a great place because it's designed not just for children, but it's designed for families. Yeah. And so we, once we got there, almost to sort of try it out, we went, I think this is where we need to be now.
And sorry, I should have made clear, it's a hospice particularly for children and young people?
Yeah, it's a children's hospice just outside Sheffield, yeah.
Yeah. And how did you find it when you got there?
It was just, I mean, it was kind of weird because it was an April heat wave. Yeah. And so it felt a bit like a very surreal holiday camp because it's a great place for kids. Like, so for our son Joe, who'd got his own room, and there's a great playground outside, and there's people who had time for him as well as for Ben, and people had time for us. Yeah. So it's an incredibly supportive environment to be dealing with something you don't want to be dealing with.
Absolutely. You mentioned Joe. Yep. He's still getting on with life. How was it for him, all this?
Joe, like me, is an introvert, so he will go and kind of process it himself. Yeah. And I think, you know, it was very difficult for him, and it is something that we'll talk to him about. But I think he was quite subdued in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you as parents, you must have been fairly focused on Ben and all that was going around him. So hard for you too, yeah. When, at the point after the scan, how long, did the doctors give you any idea what the prognosis might be, how long Ben might have?
I mean, I think they may have talked about a couple of months, and it was.
That was, yeah.
So, yeah. You know, from the scan in February, it was April before we lost Ben.
Yes, yeah. You obviously had the funeral and all that. There was one little catchphrase, though, which you mentioned in your book that I think's come up a number of times that you hit on about Ben. Do you want to just tell us what that was and why you chose that catchphrase?
Yeah, I mean, Ben was a great kid with a big personality. And Louise in particular, when it came to, you know, ways that we were going to remember him, was very creative. Yeah. You have this phrase about resting in peace, don't you? Which kind of sounds like an appropriate phrase. And she kind of went, it doesn't really feel like Ben. Right. It feels a bit kind of like nice and passive. And Ben was a big personality. Yeah. She said, rather than rest in peace, I prefer keeping Jesus busy. So right. When we thought about Ben and believe that, you know, Ben is now, you know, with his maker, then that was a phrase which felt much more fitting, that Ben's keeping Jesus busy.
Ben keeping Jesus busy. Yeah. It's great. Lovely. Keeping Jesus busy, who was Jesus for Ben? What was his understanding, as far as you know?
He had a very real, childlike, but I'd say childlike in a good way, faith. Mm. One of the things that I remember was we didn't get to go to our church that much, because we were in hospital a lot, but we did go when we could. Mm. And I remember going one Sunday, and so he was still kind of mobile at that point. And so he was jumping up and down, singing the songs.
Yeah.
And I remember that Brian, who was actually leading the church for me, a friend Brian, kind of addressing Ben. It was probably about 30 or 40 of us. Yes. And Ben was just talking back.
Yeah,
because he was not a bashful kid at all, and so, you know, Ben had, you know, a simple but real faith in Jesus.
Yeah, which I guess was helpful for you to see that.
Because frankly, what do you want for your kids? Well, you want them to know that they're loved.
Yes.
And so you want them to know that they're loved by you and that they're loved by God, and I believe that he knew them.
Yeah. Dave, I want to thank you amazingly for your book, which is very moving and very powerful. I've personally been really encouraged and, just it's very, very helpful. But you give it a great subtitle, A Journey Through Unimaginable Loss. I guess for a lot of people going through a loss like you've been through, the one thing they want to do is kind of move on and not go back there. And yet you're here tonight, you've written a book, and I know you've shared the story. What keeps you doing that, Dave?
I think, you know, we are Ben's parents. Yeah. We're always going to be Ben's parents. You don't kind of stop being a parent of a child who dies.
Right.
So you're then trying to figure out, how the heck do we do this? Yeah. And in a way, writing the book was a way of me, as an introvert, as someone who finds writing a helpful thing to do, starting to process that journey. Of you know, how do we do this? How do we do life? How do we deal with difficulty? Yes. And actually what you then begin to realise is that by being very real and open about that, you help other people to do that.
Yes.
So we ended up being, having been, you know, helping lead a church and then coming away from that, and being in another church, and then starting to lead a cell group, people who led not by being really good at all this stuff and knowing all the answers, but who led out of a place of needing God and honesty and brokenness, and that helps other people.
Yes.
So I think you kind of have no choice but to have this in your life, therefore let's try and do something useful with it, because it's not going anywhere.
No.
You know, there's no point pretending about it. So I guess that's our heart is, you know, when something helps us, we realise that then helps other people, and that's got to be a good thing.
And I guess both then and in the years since, you've had other people who've tried to be helpful.
Yep.
If you had to pick up one or two of the things that have been the most helpful, what would you say they've been for you and for Louise, would you say, Dave?
I think it's a lot of it is about friends who just are there, actually.
Yeah.
So Nigel and Nessa, who are here tonight, are wonderful friends who are just available to us. And they have their own story of losing their son, actually. When I think about the immediate aftermath, actually, before we'd met these guys, there were people who just opened their homes and their lives to us.
Yes.
And they weren't trying to be clever about it. They weren't trying to fix us.
No.
They were just available. And that was incredibly profound. And I think that's something that we'd want to be for others.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that's good about being in a church and you know, it's great being in a community venue as well, is when you want to support people, I think actually it's good to do that as community.
Yeah.
But we were incredibly blessed by people who just made themselves available to us.
Yeah. Just one or two more questions before we give you a bit of a break. You mentioned in your book, and you've kind of hinted at a little bit in your answers, that you've now what you call a new theology,
yep,
a slightly different understanding of sickness and God and prayer and the messiness of life as it is. What, do you want to share a bit of that with us and how you've made sense of this, as it were, from a Christian point of view?
Yeah.
If you have.
Yeah, you? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that in terms of where we are in the book, there's sort of fragments of understanding rather than here is the answer, here's the answer to suffering. You know, apart from a kind of a general sense of what we need in suffering is someone who's going to help us with it, because suffering is not just going to stop being a thing. When I think about my theology, my understanding of God, I would say that beforehand, I would have said, because I'm a Christian, I can say what's going to happen. So I had that sort of sense of certainty, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I could say, my son is ill, I believe my son is now going to be healed. And obviously, that theology essentially broke.
Yeah.
And now I would say that my theology is, whatever happens, I believe that God is there, because God has been there for us. God's been faithful to us. But what I've had to go back and figure out is, what did I expect of God then?
Yeah.
And was I expecting the right things?
And do you think you were?
Not entirely, no, because I think that what does God actually promise? And I think that what God promises is that he will be with us. So 2 years after we lost Ben, I lost my job.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was going to happen. And God said he'd be with me. And in my first reaction was kind of, is that the best you've got, God? I'd really like to know what's going to happen. I'd really like to know I'm going to have a job. And he didn't promise me that.
No.
He promised that he'd be with me. And he was. And I got a job. But the promise was there that I'll be with you. And so my understanding of God now is that I don't pretend I can predict it all, explain it all, tidy it all up. But I believe that the promise of God is that whatever happens in a world where we all see difficulty, where we all experience it, is that he promises that he will walk with us through those things, that he'll be faithful, and that he will provide. And that's absolutely our experience.
Playing a devil's advocate a little bit here, if I
yeah.
may. Some might be wondering, Dave, how can a figure from 2,000 years ago, you know, albeit historical figure, but yep. that's a long, long time ago. How does that seriously make sense of life, and particularly a life of great loss that you've known? How can that really impact today? Do you want to? How would you apply to that?
I mean, I think historically Jesus is completely unique. I don't see anybody else. People are still looking at Jesus' teachings. If you look at the Sermon on the Mount, I don't think anybody's ever got near that teaching. I think that there is an offer there in Jesus which is different than I see anywhere else. And the word that I would use to kind of sum that up is a word that can sound like a bit of a churchy word, but it's the word grace.
Okay.
And the idea of grace is that it's not about what you can do, it's about what he can do.
Right.
So actually it's about not you reaching this God and making yourself acceptable, figuring him out. It's about him reaching you.
Yeah.
And I would say that as our experience, again, of God himself and through community reaching into our circumstance. So one of the things that I sometimes say is God doesn't promise to stop life being messy. He says he'll step into the mess with us. And so that's what I experience in faith. And I think that's the offer of Jesus, and I don't see that offer anywhere else.
No, no. Just one final thing, Dave, just to ask. After a loss like yours, do you come to a point where you kind of, it's finished, you draw a line? You know, we use all that sort of language sometimes, don't we, about grief and about loss. Do you think that does happen? Do you think you can say it's behind, or do you think, actually, no, this is a loss I will always, this will be part of us? So how does that feel for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I said before, we're still parents.
Yeah.
And so you don't kind of get to a point where you don't experience that loss anymore. But it changes. And a phrase I use in the book, which is a care for the family phrase, which is about finding a new normal. So what people want for you with really good intentions after something like this is they desperately hope that your life can get back to normal, because they want that for you.
Yeah.
And it can't.
No.
It absolutely can't, because normal is gone.
Yeah.
And so there needs to be a new life, and new life contains this grief.
Yes.
But it is possible to develop a new life and to adapt to loss.
Yeah.
And that's not a straightforward thing. So it's not that you think it'll be all right after 3 months or 6 months, after a year, because in my experience, grief is kind of like that.
Yes.
Things can trigger it, things can bring it up. Sometimes in a way that you expect, because it's like a key date.
Yeah.
Sometimes just completely out of nowhere. Yeah. So it's about finding a new life that is not just about that, but where that's a part of it.
Dave, thank you so much. I think folks will appreciate it's not an easy thing to sit up here and be grilled and to share things that have been so profoundly part of your life and are still. Dave, we are really, really grateful. Do you think we might persuade you with the lure of a cup of tea to come back a little bit later
absolutely.
And
to.
Answer some questions? I think Louise will join you. Can we just thank Dave? Thank you so much.